The Guardian.
Hi, Nicola Davis here. Before you get started with this edition of Science Weekly, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian and get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
I can't think of any more human activity than conducting science experiments. Think about it. What do kids do?
In 1996, the Hayden Planetarium in New York appointed their youngest ever director, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson.
They're exploring their environment through experimentation.
With 13 books, a string of honorary degrees, a popular podcast, and numerous TV series to his name, to say that Neil is one of the world's most prominent communicators of science would be nothing short of the truth.
It helps to have opposable thumbs, of course, and really huge heads.
But where did his passion for astrophysics begin? What's the secret to his awe-instilling approach? And how important is scientific thinking in the wider world?
Start doing that later. Before that happens, every child is a scientist. And so when I think of science, I think of a truly human activity, something fundamental to our DNA.
I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
Actually, I don't. Oh, breakfast. I had a highly crispy corned beef hash and two eggs over easy.
With his latest book, Welcome to the Universe, hot off the press, I sat down with Neil this week.
I'm a fan of huge breakfasts, which I think is consistent with English, correct?
Yes.
As opposed to continental breakfast?
Yeah.
Having spent much of his career inspiring a sense of scientific awe in others, I wanted to know what it was that first inspired Neil.
My first encounter with the universe was at my local planetarium, the Hayden Planetarium in New York City. And think about it, if you grew up in a city, London would count in this category, you don't have a relationship with the night sky. There's light pollution and air pollution and tall buildings, and there's nothing that prompts you to embrace anything that's going on. Maybe the moon, the sun, a couple of stars, that's it. So to have seen the full night sky in all of its glory as projected on a planetarium dome, this was a singular experience in my life. And to this day, I think that the universe called me, and I had no say in the matter. I was only 9, and it would take a couple of years to formulate that desire into a career path. So by age 11, if you asked me, what do you want to be when you grow up? I had an answer. And it wasn't, you know, doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, cowboy. It was astrophysicist. It was there. I was there for you. There it was.
It's been said elsewhere that you were almost drawn to astronomy in a kind of addictive sense. Was it a healthy addiction? Did you get really hooked on this?
Yeah, I was hooked. Everything in my life was organized around learning more about the universe. So some people thought that that was weird or bad, or that I needed to diversify my portfolio of interests. But why stop learning? If you have incentive, motivation to learn, then why not? Why stop someone from ever doing that? So particularly if there is interest and pleasure taken in it. At the time, I don't know if they have it here, but in the United States, there's surely some version of it here in the UK. The United States back then, bookstores would have a table of scattered books that were called remainder books. And remainders were the publishers trying to shake the warehouse tree and get rid of things that are not selling. And then they release it at dirt cheap prices. So my mother, upon seeing I was interested in science and the universe in general, would go to the remainder table and pick up any book if it had anything to do with science and math. And it would cost, these books are marked on the top with a marker, so there's a, you know that they're discounted. These books cost 50 cents or a dollar, not more than a dollar, right? So I had probably the largest library of any 13-year-old child, just simply because of this fact, because my parents knew what I was interested in. I knew what I was interested in. When you know that early, you can align forces of your life to serve that interest. And it's something I took for granted until I got to college, realizing half of everyone I went to college with in freshman year, first year, didn't know what they wanted to major in. And I said, wow, how could you not know? I've known my whole life. Oh, my gosh. So to this day, I go to mountaintops with the finest viewing conditions that exist for the night sky, where we put telescopes. And I look up, and this is a sickeningly urban thing to say, but I look up and say, reminds me of the Hayden Planetarium.
You gave your first lecture in your teens, and you came into contact with Carl Sagan, who is probably best known amongst many people for his role in Cosmos, the fantastic TV series, which you've rebooted, in fact,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How did it come about, your meeting with Sagan, and what impact did that have on you?
So my first public talk was when I just turned 15. And so that has a special place in my life, not so much that I gave the talk to adults in a room of about 50 adults, but that they paid me to do it. It was like, oh my gosh. So I was paid $50 to give this talk. That's what they paid anyone else who would come in and give a guest lecture to this class. I felt kind of cheap, actually. It was like, I'm just telling you what I know. This is like describing my living room or something. I'm describing the universe. Did I sweat? Did I bleed? Did I toil? No. So it was odd to be compensated just for sharing knowledge. I would learn that's, you know, the world goes around. But a couple of years later, I'm applying to colleges, and one of them was Cornell, where Carl Sagan was a professor. And I was admitted to Cornell, and I was admitted early to Cornell, and they wanted to enhance the chance that I might go, I would later learn. And so the admissions office sends my application to Carl Sagan, and then Carl Sagan writes me a letter, a personal letter. Dear Neil, signed Carl. You know, it was like, I hear you might consider Cornell. If you come to visit, I'd be happy to greet you and show you around. I was like, what? And I already knew I wanted to study the universe. That's what the admissions office was noticing, and they're just trying to get him to jump in. So I did visit Cornell, and he greeted me outside the building, and we went in and toured the lab, and he reached behind his desk and pulled out a book he wrote and signed it to me, to Neil, future astronomer. I still have that book. And I realized, wow, this guy's really, if I'm ever remotely as famous as this man, I am now committed forever to treat students rising up with ambitions to study the universe the way he has treated me. Because who am I? I was nobody. It didn't end there. He drives me back to the bus station. This happened in December. And Ithaca, New York, it's snowy and cold there. Cold as in, you know, 0 degrees Fahrenheit, okay? Like real zero. Not this fake Celsius zero stuff. Give me some serious zero action. Zero on the Fahrenheit scale. So I'm there, and he drops me off at the bus station, begins to snow, and he writes down his home phone on a piece of paper, and it says, if the bus doesn't come through, call me, spend the night with my family, and return tomorrow. Ever since then, people have said, you should have just told him the bus didn't come through. Just chilled with him. So anyhow, that's the account of my first meeting with Carl Sagan.
Despite Sagan's warm welcome, Tyson instead went to Harvard, majoring in physics before going on to receive an MA from the University of Texas at Austin, and later a PhD in astrophysics from Columbia University in 1991. It was 3 years before Neil would return as a staff scientist to the very planetarium that so inspired him as a child, before becoming its director in 1996.
Yeah, subtle differences.
Overseeing the planetarium's $210 million reconstruction project, Neil hit the headlines in 2001, but not exactly in the way he would have imagined.
As we were designing the place in the late 1990s, because we opened in 2000, we looked around and said, we're about to cut metal into exhibitry. We want to make sure that whatever we cut into metal has high shelf life. Otherwise, you're bankrupting the future maintenance costs of the institution. So how do we do this? So we looked around and said, all right, in 1995, new objects were discovered orbiting beyond Neptune in the solar system. Well, they're small like Pluto. They're icy like Pluto. They have weird kind of cockamamie orbits like Pluto. maybe Pluto is not its own singular entity. Maybe it was the first object of a new class of objects now filling in with new data. So that's the role we took. We felt that was very future looking on this. And so the exhibit of the planets has eight planets, and the exhibit of the outer solar system has Pluto and other icy bodies. That's all we did. We didn't have a big sign saying, "We demote thee," you know, or whatever. There was no, we weren't in your face about it. We were very scientific. And by the way, it went for a year without anybody reacting until the New York Times sent a reporter, and they discovered this. And then the next day, page one story. Pluto not a planet? Only in New York. And they were trying to say that we were just completely out of it and that the rest of the world didn't agree and that we had issues. I got a call from the provost and the president of the institution. What are you doing? I think they were already skeptical because I was kind of young as a director, because I was hired as director of the place. And I think they really didn't trust me from the beginning. And now I just got them in trouble with the New York Times. But the real impact wasn't the people reading the New York Times. It was angry, really pissed off 10th graders, school children, who had just freshly memorized the planets in order, and now somehow I ruined their day. And in the United States, of course, Pluto is not just the cosmic object, it's Mickey's dog. And whatever stereotypes you have of America, they're correct, especially with regard to Disney, which just everything is Disney. Everything is guns. Everything is whatever. You're correct. Whatever you stereotype America, it's more that than you think it is. So you think there's a little Disney, there's a lot of Disney. And at about that age, you're watching Disney cartoons and Mickey's dog Pluto. So I think in America, people had more trouble with the demotion of Pluto than elsewhere around the world. Plus, an American discovered Pluto. So that was a double hit.
Has the controversy died down now?
Yes, it has. I think the 10-year-olds... It went back when we did this, are now like in college or graduated. So, and they have other sort of issues in life to concern themselves with. They're not writing me mail, although one person did. One person who got into college, this is now 10 years after his letter, he said, "Dear Dr. Tyson," this was written straight deadpan, okay? "Dear Dr. Tyson, now that I'm older, I got a chance to review the case regarding Pluto and the arguments you made 10 years ago. And I've come to agree with everything you said. So I'm sorry that when I was 8 years old, I wrote you a letter calling you a poo-poo head." That was the letter. So, yeah, it's died down. And in 2006, the international community of astrophysicists that are in charge of nomenclature voted to just create this new category called dwarf planet. And Pluto became sort of the benchmark new member of that category. So we were vindicated ultimately, but I got blamed for it. And I'll admit to being an accessory, but the real cause was we were discovering other objects in the outer solar system that forced the question.
Closing the chapter on Pluto, I wanted to explore another section of Neil's book entitled Search for Life in the Galaxy.
In the book, Welcome to the Universe, it was a course I co-taught with two of my colleagues, and we got together and put the book together. It tries to get the frontier of astrophysics. It's an introduction to astrophysics, yes, but unlike so many other books that are a mile wide, this is, it's also a mile deep. So one of the sections where we want to make it clear where all the frontiers are, and then give you the latest understanding of how we come to think about those frontiers. That's the mile deep part. So there's a famous thing called the Drake Equation, a way to estimate how many civilizations might be out there that you talk to using radio telescopes or some other means of communication. And I can give a simplified version of the Drake Equation, which gets the idea across. You just start out with the number of stars in our galaxy. It's a large number, hundreds of billions. Well, I say it in a Carl Sagan way. Hundreds of billions of stars. And so you say, all right, what fraction of those stars have planets? If life has to exist on a planet, what fraction have planets? So you come up with what that fraction is, either from data or from supposition. All right, what fraction of the stars with planets could sustain life as we know it. That would be a planet in the Goldilocks zone. Not too close, otherwise you evaporate the water, too close to the star. Not too far away, you freeze. We need liquid water. Every place on Earth is liquid water, there's life. So, now you ask, what fraction of the planets that could have life do have life? And what fraction of the planets that can have life and do have life have intelligent life? And what fraction of the planets that do have, that can have life and do have life and have intelligent life have civilization? Presumably cavemen were intelligent. I mean, they were the same as us. They just didn't have technology. So you want to talk about civilization with technology that can then talk back. So you're hacking away at this large number, taking, you know, it's one-tenth and one-hundredth of that tenth. You keep doing this, and in the end, there's a number. There's a number. Now, the precise Drake equation has a couple of other terms that complicate it a little bit, but what I just said is the essence of it. And in the end, you ask, what's your number? And we did that full-blown calculation in the book with the very latest estimates of those terms, and we came up with between 1 and 200 civilizations in the galaxy today that you can have a conversation with, which for us was quite encouraging.
That's pretty impressive. I mean, do you think that we're any closer to actually making contact with any of those if they are out there?
No. All the calculation asks is if they're out there. And then you can ask, are they trying to communicate with us? What are we doing to try to communicate with them? We've been mostly watching for them rather than sending signals, although we have very inadvertent signals that we've been sending. So, you know, early television are radio signals that escaped Earth and are expanding away from us at the speed of light. So we call that the radio bubble.
So they might be able to pick up the Goon Show, is that what
you're saying? Yeah, and just keep in mind that those earliest television shows are now the diplomatic emissaries of our civilization.
It seems Neil is sanguine about the possibility of aliens being out there, but while it's interesting to ponder questions such as these, another aspect of his character is his role in the promotion of science to solve real-world issues. And after this short break, we'll hear Neil's thoughts on scientific progress, the media circus, and the benefits of critical thinking.
I think we've lost the capacity of inquiry. We've lost our curiosity out of childhood as we entered adulthood. And I blame it on adults, because as a kid, you spend the first couple of years of a child's life teaching them to walk and talk. And you spend the rest of their lives telling them to shut up and sit down.
We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Jason Phipps here, ruler of all things podcast here at The Guardian. Just to let you know that this episode is sponsored by the good people at Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Before we kick off again, I want to recommend another one of our podcasts here at The Guardian. It's called Audio Long Reads and contains some of The Guardian's best journalism in the form of long read articles from the paper. Recent long reads include Giles Tremlett's piece on the shocking murder of Spain's most flamboyant politician and Anna Altman's account of living with migraines. To subscribe to Audio Long Reads, head to theguardian.com/podcasts or get it on your favorite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Nicola Davis. Before the break, we heard Neil deGrasse Tyson's take on the world-famous Drake equation, an equation which explores the possibility of alien existence in the galaxy.
All of its glory, as projected on a planet.
But do such musings, and indeed the exploration of space itself, help us to tackle issues such as climate change here on Earth?
let me give a shortened version of what for me would be like a 30-minute answer to that question. When you walk into a hospital and you see all these machines at work diagnosing the condition of the human body without cutting you open. So that would include something as simple as a stethoscope, but also, you know, the blood pressure sphygmomanometer, I think they're called. You'd have the PET scans, CAT scans, MRIs. Not many people realize that every one of those machines that has an on-off switch, including X-ray machines, is based on a principle of physics discovered by a physicist who had no interest in medicine. So you can't say, let's advance medicine by diverting funding to the medical sciences. That'll make some progress, maybe evolutionary progress, but it won't make revolutionary progress. That comes historically from deeply cross-pollinating different fields where you didn't see it coming. If you're an expert in stoves, and I hand you a potbelly stove or whatever they might have been called regionally, where you put wood in the stove, and I say, here's $1 billion. I want you to improve the stove. You might make it more insulated, more efficient. It might run on a different multiple fuels. You might have thermometer probes. You would have all these innovations. And you know something? You will have never invented the microwave oven, because it does not derive from any incremental thinking you can do on a traditional oven. The microwave oven comes from communication technologies with microwaves, cross-pollinating with what the chef might have in the kitchen. So, why go into space when we have real problems here on Earth? If I can tell you that going into space will attract the best and the brightest, and they will have to innovate to do things that have never been done before, and out of that will transform Earth from a sleepy planet to an innovation culture, and then you have a way to cross-pollinate one discovery with another, oh my gosh, there you have it. I got it. It may be that the person who wants to terraform Mars into Earth, because Mars is cool, maybe that's the person who discovers how to cure global warming. Otherwise, you're going to force that person to sit down and say, cure global warming right here. That's not any more fertile than me telling you, invent a microwave oven from this wood-burning stove. You're not going to do it. You don't know how to do it. It's not going to work. So I assert that history tells us that fertile investments in the entire frontier of the sciences and engineering and math, these are the engines of tomorrow's growth economies. If you do that and have people research in whatever excites them, you will have answers to questions that you thought were intractable. You will have solutions to problems that have yet to even arise, because that'll be sitting there on the shelf. And say, wow, we've already did that for this other planet, and we just encountered that here on Earth? Let's do it. And by the way, sometimes those solutions are not high-tech. For example, I don't know if they have it here in the United States, off-ramps of the highway, many of them are grooved. Grooved, just etches in the pavement. Why? It prevents the car from sliding over to the shoulder if the conditions are slightly wet, or if you didn't slow down enough from the higher speeds of the highway. Well, who came up with that? Because it's relatively recent. NASA came up with that. NASA. Well, that looks kind of high tech for NASA. Well, it's because they put those grooves in the landing path of the shuttle, because they didn't want the shuttle to drift sideways once it made contact with the running bed. And the shuttle is just a glider landing. It doesn't have control over its surfaces. So you might say, well, we could have invented that without the $18 billion a year NASA budget. But you didn't. But you didn't. No one did. So the urge to not have the shuttle slide was what got the brilliant person to come up with that suggestion, not forcing the person to say, how do we stop cars from sliding on an off-ramp? That's my 5-minute version of what really should be a 30-minute answer to that question.
As well as being one of the world's most formidable communicators of all things scientific, Neil believes his role as an educator goes further than that.
To a career path?
One issue that cropped up was the apparent rise in sexism and racism following recent elections in his home country of the United States.
There's the sense that there's a rise of sexism or racism, and that's not what I see. what I see is it's better than ever before. Just let's pause for a moment, okay? I know the news of the United States better than other news. So there's a policeman that shoots an unarmed black teenager, okay? And it makes headlines across the country. That used to happen all the time, and it didn't make any headlines at all. It would barely make the local news. The fact that when it happens anywhere now, it's national news is progress. So your awareness of something happening doesn't mean it's happening more often. It just means we have reached a level of caring and consideration to try to do something about it. Same with the sexism. Oh my gosh, if you go back 10 years, 20 years, and look at how people were treated in the workplace, guy would slap you on the butt, and that would just be okay, and there's nothing you can do. There was no recourse. Companies didn't even have human resource departments. Now there's mechanisms to handle that. Oh my gosh. I think it was Louis C.K., the comedian, who joked that time machines, which so many people get excited about, let's go back in time and see, are not good for women or black people. Think about that. There is no time in the past where you or I are treated better than today. Period. In addition to that question, sometimes people complain the violence of today, and you see, you know, the explicitly filmed violence of ISIS and terrorist bombings, and people think that the world is just ready to go off the cliff. However, just run the numbers on this, okay? How many people have ISIS killed? I don't know what that number is. It's certainly in the thousands, okay, perhaps. Well, between 1939 and 1945, 1,000 people were killed per hour of every day of every year from 1939 to 1945 as victims of the Second World War. 1,000 people per hour. I don't know of a more violent time in our culture than that. So while, yes, any violence is bad, and we should not ignore it, and we should try to solve it, don't tell me we are living in specially violent times, because we're not.
You've often said the most important thing is to encourage people to think in a scientific way, to think in a logical way, to take the material and process it and come out with a rational conclusion. How do you encourage adults in this era of fake news and this post-truth climate to actually do that, to apply critical thinking? I mean, it's perhaps easier with children. You can bring them up in that regime. But how do we tackle that amongst adults?
Yeah, I just give up on adults. I don't. No. So first, I don't think I ever use the word logic. Logic has a very specific and restricted role in science. It's when you make a mathematical model of an idea and now you want to crank the math, that the math happens purely logically, but the ideas do not. There's nothing logical about particles popping in and out of existence, all right? Unless you study and find out what the mathematical principles are that emulate reality, and then you crank that through. So what matters to me is not logic. What matters is your capacity to ask questions. If I'm going to sell you crystals and I say, these will heal all your ailments, what is your response? Is it, oh, great, wow, here's the money, here's 10 quid, all right? Or is it, oh, that's BS, that'll never work. By the way, each of those responses is equally scientifically lazy. In one case, you say it couldn't ever be true. In the other case, you say it's definitely true. It's harder to ask questions. And you say, oh, by what mechanism do they work? What kinds of diseases do you say they cure? What evidence do you have that they cured these diseases? What are the crystals made of? Where did you get them? Can you demonstrate? By the time you're done, the person has walked away because they're not going to heal you. Okay, we know this in advance, but why not ask the questions? And so we would have a much stronger electorate, much more enlightened electorate, if people approached information with a healthy dose of skepticism, but not to the point of denial, just to the point of inquiry. One of the news stories was Hillary was running a sex ring or something, and it's like Hillary Clinton. It's like, okay, is that consistent with anything else you know about her? Where was this ring? What is this news source? Who are the people? What is? Just ask questions. And generally, that gets you most of the way there towards where the truth lies. So I think we've lost the capacity of inquiry. We lost our curiosity out of childhood as we entered adulthood. And I blame it on adults, because as a kid, you spend the first couple of years of a child's life teaching them to walk and talk. And you spend the rest of their lives telling them to shut up and sit down. All right? That's a problem.
It's this kind of healthy skepticism that Neil hopes to encourage in scientists and non-scientists alike. But it's not just critical thinking that he believes people can gain from a study of science.
There are people who might think that science and the study of the universe in particular is sort of the opposite of what might be the source of their spiritual fulfillment, either be they religious or any other exploration of mind, body, and soul. I can just make some simple statements about the universe that I think might classify as being spiritually deep, that the very atoms of our bodies, the molecules which contain carbon and nitrogen and oxygen, you can ask, well, where did these come from? I asked that of my high school chemistry teacher. He said, well, they're available in the earth, and the iron, well, we get it, it's in the earth. And I said, well, where'd the earth get it? And they didn't quite have a good answer, but we know where it came from. They were forged in the cores, in the crucibles of high-mass stars that manufactured the heavy elements from the lighter ones from which they were born, and then they explode as what we call supernova, scatter their enriched guts across the galaxy. It comes to gas clouds that then collapse and form star systems with these extra ingredients that can now carve out planets and people. So that it's not a figurative truth, it is a literal truth that we are stardust. And not only do we exist in this universe, you can justifiably argue that the universe lives within us.
Special thanks this week to Neil deGrasse Tyson. His fantastic new book, Welcome to the Universe, is out now and can be found in all good bookshops, including The Guardian's.
Something that drives curiosity. They go together. The act of being curious and the act of wanting to do the experiment. When you conduct science, it is the natural world that is the ultimate decider on what is true and what is not.
So, I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.